From PRI and WNYC, this is the podcast of Studio 360, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversations about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support Studio 360 by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more. Studio 360's podcast is supported by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, working together to foster a greater appreciation of authentic modern designs for the home.
Famous musicians, especially rock stars, are not exactly known for their humility.
I've been making records now for 16 years. I've been a has-been a few times.
But Moby has no problem sizing himself up.
I'll never say I'm good at making music, but I'm prolific.
Today in Studio 360, the ubiquitous contemporary music maker Moby talks about his new career retrospective. And I'll talk with Brian K. Vaughan, one of today's most interesting writers of comic books, who's finding out that he's hot in Hollywood.
I talked with one executive. I said, you know, we really see this as our tentpole Ben Stiller summer comedy. And I said, you do know it opens with the deaths of 3 billion people vomiting out their organs.
Plus, a conversation with Dave Eggers. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The war in Iraq is 3.5 years now and counting, and the pop cultural depictions of that war are now starting to proliferate. A couple of movies are imminent, but one of the most interesting treatments is in print, a comic book. It's by Brian K. Vaughan, who in the past has created his own popular series of comics, as well as writing for mainstream books like Spider-Man. Vaughan's new graphic novel is called Pride of Baghdad. It's set at the very beginning of the war in 2003. It begins with a true story about a pack of lions in the Baghdad Zoo who were liberated when the bombing started. But in the comic, the lions guess that something is very wrong when their zookeepers throw them an extra meal.
Is that an ass?
Smells like one. This is enough meat to last days. Why would the keepers feed us an entire donkey right after we just...
Oh, no. They're leaving.
Who? The keepers. Why?
Noor, get Ali to the den quickly before...
Zell, are you... Are you writing? This is the end.
Get inside and keep your mouth shut, Papa. We have to...
Don't you dare bark at me, you scrawny excuse for a... Is everyone all right?
Are we dead?
No. We're free.
Yes! This isn't right.
What's that supposed to mean, Noor? I thought this was all you ever wanted.
There's an old saying, Zell. Freedom can't be given, only earned.
Yeah? Well, there's another old saying. You don't look a gift horse in the mouth. You eat him.
That was our dramatization of a scene from Brian K. Vaughan's comic Pride of Baghdad. Brian joins me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me, Kurt.
So Pride of Baghdad was inspired by an actual event.
A true story. Mm-hmm. And it was something I read just a small article, I think it was an overseas news source, just talking about these pride of four lions who escaped a Baghdad zoo during the initial American invasion.
And was that the end of your premise, or did you try to make it bear some relationship to what happened in real life?
I just started by knowing I wanted to write an anthropomorphic animal comic, which sounds bizarre, but comics have a really rich tradition of doing that pretty well, from, you know, Scrooge McDuck all the way up to Mouse. So on one hand, I wanted to do talking animals, and at the same time, it was 2003, I did want to talk about my conflicted feelings about the Iraq War, but I'd never imagined combining the two ideas until I read this story. And from there, I knew it would be a good starting point, but that we'd need a lot of artistic license to fill in the gaps.
Now, the real story that people probably remember, because it was an amazing story at the time, that these lions were killed.
They were.
And as you were putting together this comic and thinking about Iraq and inhabiting the minds of these lions, did your views of that incident or the war change?
It did. Yeah, I would say that it did, especially watching everyday Iraqis talk about their experiences. And I sort of knew if I just, you know, told a story about an Iraqi family, even I know when I hear about Iraqi casualties, you can sort of intellectually feel for the victims. But, you know, it's sad to say that we can't empathize with them the way that we could for fallen American soldiers. But I knew that animals, because they don't have race or creed or nationality, they sort of transcend.
Or culpability in any sense.
Right. It's that innocence, you know. And I always say, you know, when people are at the movies, you can put a child in jeopardy or hurt a baby and the audience will be with you. But if you even threaten to harm a dog, you know, your audience will walk out in droves. There's just something about animals.
So it seems, having read a good chunk of your oeuvre now, that one of your main modes is social satire. Do you think of yourself as a satirist?
Yeah, that sounds fair. I like the thought of that. You know, Y was born out of wanting to talk about gender issues and Ex Machina about politics and in sort of unconventional ways. So, sure, social satirist. I like the sounds of it.
And did you ever think, given that you don't draw your books and comics, did you ever think of, I'll just write novels? Or was the graphic mode always the one you wanted to do?
No, I've always been drawn to visual mediums. And as a writer, too, it's, I think most writers like writing dialogue the most and everything else is sort of the heavy lifting. And comics, we have the benefit of leaving most of that stuff to our artist, you know, and we just get to dwell in the spoken word. So it's a perfect medium.
And since you are a writer and not a visual artist, how does the relationship with your visual artists work?
Oftentimes I'll never even meet the artist.
Nico
really? Henrichsen and I, we've talked on the phone often and email every day, but I've never met him before. And it's interesting to work so closely with someone that you've never met before.
Do you have a sense of how you want this panel to look? Or no, I want it bigger here, and you're more of a pain in the ass to your artists?
I do. I like to give a very detailed roadmap to the artist, but also the freedom to diverge if they come up with better ideas, which Nico really did with Pride of Baghdad.
A few years ago, you wrote a comic called Y, The Last Man. Y as in the Y chromosome, because it's about the last male on Earth on a planet full of women. And that premise, when you hear it as a high concept, has these obvious male sex fantasy aspects, particularly I would expect for stereotypical comic book nerds.
It sounds like a bad late night Cinemax movie, yes.
But you don't really go in that direction.
No, I have always loved talking about gender, and in comics, discussions about gender rarely go beyond should she be called the invisible girl or the invisible woman or, you know, should Catwoman's boobs be smaller. So I wanted to do a story about gender and try and take this chauvinistic high concept and try and say something with it.
And as a man writing about all these women who are the survivors in this post-apocalyptic world, did you have to think differently about how to create them or what you wanted women in this situation to be like?
No, it's interesting. You know, I wrote a book called Swamp Thing before I did Why the Last Man, which is about a talking plant. And no one ever asked me, was it hard to get into the mind of a plant or to write mutants like X-Men? But people always ask, is it difficult to write women? And no, you know, all writing is the same in that you try and put yourself in that person's shoes and you sit at your keyboard and you make up lies until they sound like the truth. But
make up lies until they sound like the truth. That could go in books as a writer's guide.
I'm sure I cribbed it from somewhere then.
Your series Ex Machina is about a superhero who can communicate with machines. And in your alternate history, he prevents the destruction of the second Twin Tower, but then decides to take off his mask and run for mayor of New York. What were you trying to explore there?
Well, I was living in Brooklyn during 9/11, and my then-girlfriend, now wife, and I watched the towers fall from the roof of our apartment. And you do, as a comic book writer, as any kind of writer, you're desperate to respond to that, but you feel particularly helpless as a comic book writer. Even for people who love the medium and think it can do anything, it does seem ill-suited to talk about something so huge. But I was interested in the way that after 9/11, more than ever, people seemed to want their leaders to be quote-unquote heroes, you know, whether that was Bush in his flight suit or Kerry running on his war record or Schwarzenegger being elected governor. That idea of, you know, are there such things as heroes or is that just a fiction we impose on people comic books have been doing that brilliantly since the days of Superman. So I thought that using superheroes as a metaphor to talk about post-9/11 leaders made a lot of sense.
And you've written, as a freelance writer, the straight-ahead old-fashioned heroes like Superman and Batman, Spider-Man, I guess, as well.
Yep.
In Ex Machina, the mayor slash superhero might be gay. Could you do that in the mainstream of Marvel DC Comics?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I write a kids book called Runaways, and in there, there's a character named Carolina, and she's openly gay, and she's actually now dating an alien shapeshifter who shifts between male and female forms. So in my all-ages kids book, I'm probably addressing matters of sexuality in a more mature fashion than I am in any of my quote-unquote independent graphic novels.
You have, I understand you've been turning some of your comic book stories into screenplays. Tell me how that's going.
I have. I was a NYU film school geek, so I started writing screenplays before I fell into comics. But I've now moved to Los Angeles to work on the adaptations of Why the Last Man for New Line. And I just finished the first draft of that, and that went well enough that they've hired me to take a stab at Ex Machina as well.
And I suppose, just practically speaking, when you have comics, you're not going to have any problem getting an executive or a possible producer to read it like you would if you were writing 400-page novels.
You would be surprised. I have found that, you know, Hollywood, is, like I say, there are good people, but there are also a lot of semi-literate people who just are not into reading in any capacity, not even comic books. And I found, I think, Y got a good review early on in Entertainment Weekly that said something like it was brilliantly funny. And I think I talked with one executive who I think had only read that review and not the comic and just read the funny and said, you know, we really see this as our tent pole, you know, Ben Stiller summer comedy. And I said, you do know it opens with the deaths of 3 billion people vomiting out their organs. And I don't think he was really familiar.
Did you
with
really come
book.
Back and say that?
I did.
Good
so,
for you.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty clear at that point. I don't think it was
going
to be
so it
a
sounds
good
like
match.
Your career in Hollywood is probably nearing its end now.
Yep. Any day now.
Brian K. Vaughan, I want to thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Brian K. Vaughan's new graphic novel is called Pride of Baghdad, and you can learn more about him and his other work at our website, studio360.org. Coming up, the writer Dave Eggers helps tell the story of a refugee who escaped the horror in Sudan.
One thing about the book, what seems to be unrealistic are the things that really happened. When they say the lion grabbed someone, that's true. When they say the soldiers called the kids and chat on them after they gave them food, that is true. Most of the things that seems unacceptable are the things that yes, has indeed happened.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It is hard to believe that a few years ago, Dave Eggers was just this guy that I had lunch with sometimes, a magazine editor and writer who had started this cool little Brooklyn quarterly called McSweeney's. But then in 2000, just before his 30th birthday, he published a memoir called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. And almost overnight, he became one of the most famous young American writers, the voice of his generation. His new book, What is the What, is a mix of memoir and fiction. But the memoir isn't the story of Dave Eggers' life. It is the story of a man named Valentino Ashak Dang. He is a young refugee from the Civil War in Sudan, and Eggers has embellished and fictionalized that story. To sort all this out, I have both men with me today. Dave, Valentino, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt.
So, Dave, this is Valentino's harrowing life story. How come you wrote it as a novelized version?
Well, we met almost 4 years ago in Atlanta, and there was a woman named Mary Williams who headed up the Lost Boys Foundation, which was a group that was helping with the resettlement of Sudanese refugees. And so she wrote to me one day saying that there was a young man that was interested in writing his autobiography or a biography. He wanted to tell his story, and would I be interested in helping? So I flew out to Atlanta just to meet with Valentino and see how I could help. And that began a very long journey of trying to bring his story into a book form.
Now, most of the stuff in this book is presumably true. For instance, when lions suddenly come out and grab one of your companions and take him away, that happened?
It did. One thing about the books, what seems to be unrealistic are the things that really happened. You see, when they say the lion grabbed someone, that's true. When they said somebody was shot into the water swimming, that's true. When they say the soldiers called the kids and shot on them after they gave them food, that is true. And you will realize that in the book that most of the thing that seems unacceptable are the thing that is, has indeed happened.
So it's the mundane things that are fictional.
Yes.
That's true. We actually cut back on the actual events. There's nothing in the book that could not have happened during that time. I wanted to, for example, very slowly lay out what it was like in Mario Bai, Valentino's home village, before the war. And that's something that Valentino, it was harder to do that back and forth. I sort of had to take everything I knew and take a lot from when we went back to Sudan in 2003.
You went back together?
Yeah, we went back in about 8 months after we met, something like that. And it was a ceasefire, but it was before the peace agreement down there, so we weren't supposed to go, but we made it back to his home village, and then that I was able to sort of envision what it was like and what it would have been like before the war.
So, Valentino, now when you look back on that 15-year period, are there certain moments where you think, my God, I can't believe that happened to me?
There are movements. For example, there is situations where somebody was dying and I had to bypass them, and they are asking me for help. They needed water, they needed food, but I didn't have any. See, movement like that, flashback. And then there's time I would be like, here was me being fired a phone by the government soldiers, or the government dropped a bomb and I didn't get killed. Why did that happen? And I would say I was not unique. I was not so special than anyone who died, but maybe there was a purpose. And purpose is anything like the book we have written, and that will tell details, information of what happened in Sudan.
Dave, could you read some of the book, a passage?
Yeah. This is a passage. I'd been interviewing Valentino for probably two and a half years. When one day when he was visiting, I don't know how it started, but I might have asked a question like, in Kakuma or in either refugee camp, did you ever have an interest in girls? You were an adolescent, you know? And I think that we think, well, they're living on one meal a day, you know, as they were in Kakuma, and they're worried about being recruited as soldiers. Why would they have time for girls? But of course, Val starts talking about these four girls that he knew in Pinudo that they nicknamed the Royal Girls because they were very special. And he's been trying to impress them all semester long by being basically the teacher's pet. And the teacher is the uncle to these four girls. So everybody knows who they are. Everybody covets these girls. But at the same time, they're afraid of doing anything to upset the teacher lest they be caned after school. So here's this is when he finally has some success with the girls. It took the entire semester, but finally my efforts toward the Royal Girls bore fruit. With 1 week left before classes let out for a month, as I was leaving school one day, a gum positioned herself in front of me and said something. It was as likely as a zebra appearing before me and whistling. What had she said? I had to piece the words together. It was all so sudden, the changing of one life into another. I was so jarred I heard nothing. I had been looking at her eyes, her lashes, her mouth that was so close to mine. A shock. My sister has something to ask you, she had said. Agar, the eldest and tallest, was suddenly next to her. Her sister stomped on her foot and was punched in return. I didn't know what was happening, but it seemed good so far. "Do you want to come to lunch at our house?" Agar asked. I realized at that moment that I had been standing on my tiptoes. I righted myself, hoping that they had not noticed. "Today?" I asked. "Yes, today," they said. I thought a moment. I thought long enough to think of the wrong thing to say. "I cannot accept," I said. I could not believe I said that. Can you believe this is what I said? I had refused the royal nieces of Pinudo. Why? Because I had been taught that a gentleman refuses invitations. The lesson had been explained by my father one warm night as I was helping him close his shop, but the context was not applicable, I would later learn. Now, Val, you want to explain what that advice was, that you have to say no to the girls that are asking you to lunch?
The advice was, you know, my father one time told me that when a girl asks you out, you know, be a gentleman by refusing the offer at least first or second times and then accept it on the third attempt. And when I tried this, I realized that I had just screwed up a chance that I have worked for the last semester. And I was like, I should review some of my father's teaching. They're not going to work here. That was what happened.
It's lovely to come across this sweet coming-of-age story in the middle of this hellish war. But once you get out of Sudan and come to America and settle in Atlanta, you had a terribly traumatic experience. What happened?
I had just come back from my school, and I found a vent, a black vent, outside our parking area. And I saw people inside but didn't pay attention, and I went to my room. And I opened my apartment just to let the hot air out and turn on the cooler system. And the lady came out, the woman came out from the car and said, "Hey, could I use your cell phone? I want to call my sister, and I don't have a phone." And I said, "Okay, just here, take it." The moment I gave her my cell phone, she went straight into my room, and I said, "You can make a call outside here. You don't have to be inside my room." And she proceeded to my bedroom and locked herself in my bedroom. And I was knocked the door, and I said, "Why? That can happen." By the time I didn't even finish that statement, there were two guys already. And they were like, "Hey, Africa, what are you doing? What do you think you're doing?" And I said, "What are you doing in my room? Do you know this woman?" And they said, "Yeah. But do you know us? We're going to teach you a lesson." And it became obvious to me that I am under attack and I had to do something, maybe to get out. I tried to get out, to leave them in my room. They wouldn't let me go. And one of them pulled a laptop, my roommate's laptop, together and was taking it. And I tried to stop, and that's how they started beating me. And I started to struggle by pushing one of them, but already a pistol was removed and put in my head.
You finally get out of that. But did you think, as I would have, geez, I survived 15 years of attacks and nightmare and horror in Africa, East Africa, and here I come here, and it's not the perfect America that I'd hoped for?
I never thought about that, but like it would at any place, there are incidences like that. Crimes happen anywhere, and maybe these people didn't even know my background. If I would sit down with them and tell them what happened in detail to me, I think they will walk away. But at that point, I was their target. They were looking for something, maybe computers, maybe money, and I was their potential target. And it's interesting. Michael in the book is one of them that I'm telling this story to.
Dave, your first book was a memoir about losing your parents and raising your little brother. This book is a memoir about a man who's been violently separated from his family. Were you thinking about a connection between your life and his?
I think that the weird thing is that Valentino's parents are alive. We thought at first we were both orphans, you know, but Valentino's parents we met in Mario Bay, and they're alive and doing pretty well.
You didn't know that until 3 years ago, that your parents were alive?
It took me very long to know that, because the entire communication was cut. You don't know who was alive in your family and who is not, except if you happen to witness a member of your family die on the spot and you left. So that gap, you know, gave me a feeling that my family wasn't alive, and it was a miracle that they survived the atrocities in Sudan. They didn't go anywhere. They spent the 16 years that we were separated, you know, running from place to place and coming back to Morel Bay when the attack aren't there. And when we went to meet them, they weren't the same parent I knew. A lot of things had changed, which frustrated me a little bit. If I compare the picture of my dad right before I left him with the picture that I went and took when we went, there's a great difference. Yeah, but it was exciting to meet them again.
Valentino, Dave, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is the What is in bookstores now, and you can find out more about the book and about the Lost Boys of Sudan on our website, studio360.org. If someday I sit down to make a soundtrack of my life, I think Moby would have to be on it. And he'd probably be on yours, too. If you were alive on either side of the latest turn of the century and you happened to turn on the TV or radio during that time, it's a safe bet that you heard Moby. His 1999 album Play had a spot in my car CD player well into this century. Moby now has a new CD set of all his hits called Go, the very best of Moby, and it's a delight. Moby, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi.
So you grew up as Richard Hall.
Well, I was actually, when I was born, I was given the name Richard Melville Hall, but my parents had a sense of humor, and so they nicknamed me Moby.
Really? So that was a childhood nickname?
Yeah. Ostensibly because I'm related to Herman Melville. Whether, in fact, I am related to Herman Melville, I have no real idea.
So this wasn't a late adopted sort of rock and roll nom de plume?
No. If I was going to pick a nom de plume, I'd try and pick something a little cooler.
Yeah. And I guess it sounds like Mopey or something,
yeah,
too. And you grew up in the rich New York suburb of Darien, Connecticut.
Yeah.
Which, speaking of cred associated with names, is not the likeliest incubator of a musical superstar.
Yeah, well, Darien's a strange, strange place. First of all, I grew up dirt poor in Darien, Connecticut. My mom and I were on welfare and food stamps till I was 18, and most of my friends had parents who were, you know, CEOs of ExxonMobil or had fleets of oil tankers or were bankers or whatnot. So,
did that make you an interesting, amusing pet to all these rich kids?
I did everything in my power to hide the fact that I was dirt poor. Even to go so far as to, like, when friends would come, you know, if you're having a sleepover at someone's house, their parents come to pick you up, I would give the address of the nice house down the street.
Oh, no.
and go stand in front of it just to do everything to sort of deflect attention from the fact
that
we were really poor.
That's very sad.
Yeah, it is kind of sad.
Your music has always, I think one of the reasons I responded to it and people respond to it is this gentle kind of spirituality. Whether it's in the gospel influence or a song like We're All Made of Stars, which is spiritual in its way. And there is this general sonic sense of uplift. Has that always been a thing you've been trying to do?
Well, those are the qualities that I respond to in other people's music. And so when it comes to making my own music, those are the qualities that I try to imbue it with. It seems strange that there are people out there who don't try to imbue their music with those qualities. There's so many musicians who don't know what it's like to make a piece of music that anyone will ever cry to.
It's interesting. That's almost the kind of ambition one expects from novelists or filmmakers more than musicians often.
Well, I guess when I was growing up, what I loved about music is it was a way to have a rich emotional experience, but in a very safe way. You know, if you're like, it did because it didn't involve other people. And I appreciated that so much that when it came time to make my own music, I sort of tried to recreate that experience.
What music provided that solipsistic ecstasy for you as a kid?
Anything from like Bach, Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring, or Joy Division, Kraftwerk. I mean, granted, Kraftwerk might not be so emotionally epiphanous, but a lot of the early new
age. I was with you until you got to Kraftwerk.
But they had that, like, a beautiful melodic quality. Echo and the Bunnymen, Joy Division, and so on.
Do you have a favorite track from Play?
It's a weird record. It when it was first released, no one was interested in it. Like, I still so clearly remember the Los Angeles Times. Their review of Play was very brief, and it said, there's a song on this record called Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad? And the answer is because I just had to listen to this terrible record. So when it was released, it didn't sell, but it's since taken on such a like life of its own that I don't even have any perspective on any of the music on there. Like, I don't even know if any of the music on there is good anymore because I've heard them too many times and I don't know if they're good or bad.
Yeah. So I guess I didn't realize that history, that it was this dud. How did it go from being this dud flop thing that gets bad reviews and people don't care about to being this enormous, you know, ubiquitous icon?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it was just word of mouth. I can't think of any other reason why it became successful. I think a few people discovered it, liked it, told their friends, and then...
That must feel kind of lovely to have done... Not, I mean, success is nice, but to have done something so anomalously and inexplicably.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly... There was not a lot of precedent for a bald, middle-aged guy who makes records on cheap equipment in his bedroom going on to sell 10 million records. Like,
not so much precedent, no.
No. And especially when it came out, I was a has-been. You know, we spent 6 months going around and every record label said, no, we're not interested. You know, they were all looking to sign the next Backstreet Boys or Limp Bizkit. They certainly weren't looking to sign bald, middle-aged guys who make records in their bedroom.
Well, not only did you end up being a huge middle-aged bald success, but as I mentioned before, your music was suddenly all over soundtracks and every second commercial. Has that kind of exposure and link with advertising ever given you pause?
It always gave me pause. And it was sort of a devil's bargain. When you're licensing music to a TV show or an advertisement, on one hand, you're doing it because, you know, in my case, I've made music that I selfishly want people to hear. And the music I've made has never gotten a lot of radio support. So if you want people to hear your music, you have to avail yourself of different means. And in hindsight, I probably should have done it a lot more creatively.
No, that is interesting. And for instance, I was in Africa this summer and I suddenly saw Ben Affleck on an ad for like deodorant.
Yeah.
And I guess that exists throughout the entertainment industry.
It's incredibly common. And there's that old adage, and I'll try and say it in a way that the FCC won't get upset about, but don't defecate where you eat. You know, so a lot of American and British artists will never license their music in the UK or America. Outside of the UK or America, it's fair game.
And what is your library of samples and songs like? I mean, how enormous and...
It's actually sort of small and random. No, I have a pretty small record collection.
You're just a guy. And don't you have 3,000 sounds of water dripping that slightly nuanced differently?
Yeah, all differently recorded. You know, some recorded in tin cans, some... Because you never know when you might need a different sound
of water
dripping.
I'm glad to learn that.
I mean, I've got about 300 or 400 songs that I'm considering for the next record. And of those...
Three or 400?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not... I would never... Again, I'll never say I'm good at making music, but I'm prolific.
On this new album, which is remixed, what's your favorite track on that, if you can still have the sufficient discriminating power?
Well, there are two CDs. The first CD, if I had to pick a favorite song, it's the last song on the record. It's called God Moving Over the Face of the Waters. And it's a very quiet, classical piece of music. Strangely enough, it got a lot of attention because it was the closing music of the film Heat, when Al Pacino shoots Robert De Niro. I hope I just didn't ruin the ending of the movie.
Spoiler alert!
But of all the things on The Greatest Hits, that's the one that I love the most.
Moby, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
You can check out Go, the very best of Moby, on our website, studio360.org. Coming up, the composer John Corigliano tells us what old music finds its way into his new music.
I sort of fell in love with contemporary music by listening to Aaron Copland. The first recording that I really got excited about was the gunfight scene from Billy the Kid.
That's ahead in Studio 360. From PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're listening to music from the movie The Red Violin from a few years ago. It won the Academy Award for its composer, John Corigliano. But Corigliano was not a neophyte. He has been composing music since the 1960s, and he's won most of the major prizes, including the Pulitzer in 2001 for his Second Symphony. Jonathan Mitchell talked with John Corigliano and asked him which composer first made him go, whoa.
Before John Corigliano won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his Symphony No. 2... before he composed his Oscar-winning score for The Red Violin, and before he became one of America's most successful classical composers, he was a boy who listened.
When I was a kid in the early 50s, the LP record just came out, and I sort of fell in love with contemporary music by listening to Aaron Copland. Well, the first recording that I really got excited about was the gunfight scene from Billy the Kid. I played it over and over again because, first of all, it had a great bass drum that hit as the gunshots were done, and snare drum, da-da-da-da-da-da, and bang, the bass drum. Then a simple little melody, barroom melody, happened, and it was like a player piano, like a, you know, piano roll, excepting that it wasn't, because Copland did these very interesting things with it in terms of having the tremolo not in the piano but in the strings, so it sounded half like the piano was doing a tremolo and half not. And I started playing these on the piano and trying to figure out how he got these very ingenious things happening out of simple C major chords.
He went to the library and took out the score and tried to figure out what Copland was doing that made his music so unusually beautiful.
How at the very opening he did this very strange doubling of a fifth and an octave with an oboe and two clarinets in such a way that it really didn't sound like anything else. And I think that kind of simplicity fascinated me, how you could do something with so little that was so fresh, and really started me thinking about composing.
Corigliano was so taken with this sound that he imitated it in his earliest orchestral works. The music you're hearing now is from his first orchestral piece, written when he was in his early 20s. It's called Tournaments. By the time Corigliano wrote this piece in the turbulent mid-60s, it wasn't exactly the music of rebellion. But for the music he was imitating, that's exactly what it was. And in order to understand why, consider the music that the Germans were making in the late 19th century.
German music in the late 19th century was becoming very chromatic, just by its nature. They had had hundreds of years of tonal writing, and the way to get more interesting for them was to become more chromatic. And I think that the American school of composing really came pretty definitely from France. In the 20s, Americans were going over to Europe, and especially Paris, and getting a lot of craft and a lot of rebellion in the way that the 20th century French world was, with Stravinsky being there and Copland being there, as well as, of course, Ravel and Mio and the French composers. And coming back to the United States, they felt very strongly about establishing something American in their music.
This new American style emphasized the country's folk music traditions and strove for a broad appeal while retaining a musical sophistication.
Copland was a very great populist, and although he was an aristocratic composer, he also felt it very important to speak to the people, but to say something interesting, not just simple-minded, but simple. If you look at Appalachian Spring, Copland picking a melody with a text that almost symbolizes Americana, the gift to be simple, a Shaker hymn, and accompanying it only with not the typical chords of the thirds, but chords of seconds, fourths, fifths, and sevenths. If you harmonize something in traditional manners, you harmonize it by cadences, which have to do with the tonic chord and the dominant, the subdominant, and then other chords too, but those are the main chords. And they're triads, and they're built of chains of thirds. So in the 20th century, composers were experimenting with what would happen if I did a chain of fourths instead of a chain of thirds, for example, and got a chord that wasn't a traditional chord. What would happen if I used seconds and sevenths and fourths to harmonize? And I think American music loved that. And a lot of American composers did that. And Aaron Copland's most famous, in a sense, for codifying that language. In that time, in the United States, there was a wonderful feeling of optimism and a wonderful feeling of the people, in which we appreciated this country and the greatness of this country. And that's probably gone from most composers. The kind of disillusionment that started happening with Korea and Vietnam and all these other kinds of wars, I think, turned people away from that gentleness. And it's sad in a way, because some very great music was written in those times. And in a sense, they're played as nostalgia pieces now. But I think that it's very beautiful.
For Studio 360, I'm Jonathan Mitchell.
You can find out more about John Corigliano and about Aaron Copland at studio360.org. Sarah Fischko curates our series on living composers and the music they love. Hey, geez. One more. Good. Now, that was not the sound of a camera shutter clicking. It was the recorded sample of a camera shutter that my cell phone plays when I take a picture. It's supposed to give me that satisfying shutter feeling. These days, fewer and fewer people are using non-digital film cameras. But there are a few old-fashioned cameras, rangefinder cameras, that serious professionals still love. People like Deborah Kogan. She was a war photographer who went off to Afghanistan at the age of 22 to shoot pictures of the Afghans fighting against the Soviets in the 1980s. And today in Design for the Real World, Kogan has this appreciation of the Leica, the first practical 35mm camera, which changed photography as we know it.
I was given it as a graduation present, and I'd been used to using, regular Canon FM2s and F2s. It was hard at first because you're not shooting exactly what you're seeing. With the rangefinder, you have to line up the two images in the middle of the tiny rectangle focusing mechanism. But once you master that, which takes a day or two, then it really is kind of a simple camera to use. With the SLR, there is a mirror that drops and makes that clicking sound that now the new digital cameras have copied just so you feel like you're taking a photograph. The rangefinder, the lens just opens and shuts right onto the film itself. So if you have steady hands, which I still do, even at my tender age of 40, I can get a really clear, crisp image at a 30th of a second with my Leica. If I had one of my old FM2s here, the motion of the mirror dropping and falling and coming back up would shake the camera. This camera has that kind of old-fashioned look down to the numbers itself. It's almost like watching Space Odyssey 2001 and looking at HAL and noticing how old-fashioned HAL looks. The shutter is just this tiny little silver button on the top, next to which there is an old-fashioned counter, like an old elevator dial. The body looks like fake leather. And then at the very top, you have the aperture settings. It was truly the perfect camera for not looking like a photojournalist. It's so unobtrusive and so small and kind of delicate, and the sound that it makes is practically nothing. That was it. Did you hear that? A lot of us would take little teeny pieces of gaffer's tape and tape it over the little red Leica symbol, so then it really looks just like, a random camera that a journalist wouldn't carry. When I was sent out to do a story on the Plattspitz, which was a open-air drug market, the Swiss government had decided that they would start a needle exchange program there. And a lot of the photographers that had gone down there and tried to get pictures were beaten up or harassed. When you're hanging around heroin addicts, well, you don't really want to seem like the photojournalist with all the cameras and the flashes and all the noises that they can make. You just want to be there with one camera trying to be the fly on the wall. It really does help you to be the fly on the wall. It's not a heavy camera like the SLR cameras. It feels very natural in the hands, very organic, and the lenses are phenomenal. It is the glass of the Zeiss lenses that make Leica what it is, and it's ground by hand, or maybe they have elephants stepping on it. But it's ground in such a way that when you look at the negatives that these cameras produce, it's astounding. People that live in dark rooms and understand the grain of negative can absolutely tell the difference. Certainly, if you go look at Cartier-Bresson's pictures, especially if they're blown up big, you just can tell it's shot with a Leica. So last year I had to do a shoot for MoMA. I rented, I think it was a Canon D20, and I sat there for 2 hours trying to figure out how the damn thing worked. It was incredibly intimidating. I kept wishing while I was shooting that I just had my Leica and some black and white film. I just felt like a big old Luddite. And I guess as we get further and further away from that design, as the cameras look more and more space-agey, it's very comforting to sit here and look at my Leica.
Photographer Deborah Kogan is the author of Shutter Babe, a memoir. For more about her and to see images of Leicas through the years, click on studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Rob Weisberg,
Sarah Lilly,
Eric Malinsky,
Joseph McCannon,
John Delore,
Owen Agnew,
Blythe Sheldon,
Adam Walton,
Lori Ann Agnesi,
Brendan Baker.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, I become a character in a video game.
I shouldn't shoot at the other blue people, right?
Yeah, shoot at the red guys. Oh, that's a cameraman I'm shooting.
This is Kurt Anderson, and I go online inside the violent video game Halo.
Are you hearing the other gamers?
I am hearing the other gamers.
Okay.
As we kill them.
Yes.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
Thanks for listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.